Welcome to Mind Matters, the podcast where we talk about different topics and trends in mental health in our community. My name is Wendy McCarty Van Bemmel. I'm so happy to be your host today. And to my right, we have
Gabriel Fernandez, community liaison and mental health advocate.
And co-host extraordinaire.
Welcome to Mind Matters podcast. Thank you for having me.
And our guest today is Chief Ogden. Can you introduce yourself a little bit to us? Thank you.
Yeah, Chief Dave Ogden. I am current chief of the Windermere Police Department. I've been in law enforcement just a little while, 37 years.
Just a little while.
Glad to be here today to get a topic of discussion for us about mental health.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Yes, our topic today is mental health and law enforcement within our community and how those two kind of intersect. And we're so happy to have you join us today. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah. So I'd love to maybe start the conversation off with maybe since you've been in it for such a long time, where we started versus where we are right now in regards to mental health and what you've seen change over the past few years in law enforcement?
Wow, that's a good question. 37 years, 3.5 decades is a long time. And I could say, you know, it's been about almost 3 decades that we started talking about mental health, but the beginning of that conversation wasn't very good.
Okay.
You know, and it was trying to encourage people to, you know, to get in touch with themselves and be a better person or if they're having difficult times. But it really did not take very well, to be honest with you. You know, if you go back to the history of law enforcement, a lot of law enforcement came from military. It's a paramilitary organization. And I think because of that, there was really just a reluctancy for people to talk about needing some help or really wasn't even any information about post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, PTSI. None of that stuff obviously was even out there at that time. So I think most officers just kind of grin and bear it. I'll tell you a story that will actually just tell you exactly what it was. My very first day on patrol.
Okay.
I was a brand new police officer. I'll never forget it. It was January in 1988. It was cold outside. I sat in a police car. It was super cold. And my training officer was a elderly gentleman, super brilliant, but he was pretty cantankerous, if that describes him a little bit. And he started smoking a cigarette inside the car. Now I don't smoke. But it's cold out. My window's rolled up, and he smokes a cigarette, and he blows it out. He says, "Hey, boy." He goes, "Do you drink?" I said, "No, sir." He said, "Do you cuss?" I said, "No, sir." He says, "Well," he said, "How many times have you been married?" I'm like, "Well, just once, sir." And he smokes his cigarette. He blows it out in the entire car, and I'm choking to death over there. And he turns him, and he says, "Heck, boy, you ain't going to make it." Think about my very first experience in a patrol car.
Yeah.
I better start cussing. I better start drinking. I better start swearing. I better have multiple wives because that's what you're going to need. And that's what you're going to need from a mental health perspective is what he was telling me. I had no idea.
I can't imagine what was going through your head at that young age. I would have been too.
I just sat there with my book and said, yes, sir.
Gripped the sides and they're like, okay.
Yes, sir. But I think that story really describes what the culture of law enforcement was at the time.
Yeah.
Where do you think the culture started to shift?
Wow. You know, a culture shift is the toughest thing to do.
It really is.
I've been at the Windermere Police Department as a chief for a little over 10 years, and we have completely transitioned the culture. Anybody that's been around here would understand that. And it's got to take time. You got to understand that it's got to take time. You've got to be consistent. You've got to be dedicated to doing that. And I think probably within about the last 20 years when we really started realizing how much of an effect it had on law enforcement. Law enforcement officers' suicide rate has a tremendous amount. I can tell you within a couple of years, I experienced law enforcement suicide within 2 years of starting the job. And I've experienced
high stress rates.
Exactly. Law enforcement officers being killed in the line of duty. 37 years, I've known 32 officers been killed. 5 of them have worked for me.
Wow.
That's a lot of stress.
That is.
So I think when people really started collecting the data and started looking at it, they were like, oh my goodness, what's happening? There's a recent data out there last year in a conference I was at, said that, you know, the average divorce rate around the country is around the 50%. I won't argue whether it's a little higher, a little lower, whatever. But they were indicating that the average divorce rate for a law enforcement family is in the 70 percentile range.
Significant.
That's significant. Yeah. That's a significant increase. And why is that? Well, because of everything. Because of my first story. Mm-hmm. Right? Because of that. Because people
that kind of
engage.
Suck it up. Don't talk about it. Find you a coping mechanism and hold on tight.
That's it. Go along for the ride.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. So you started to see a culture shift. And of course, that takes some time. What were some of the key elements of that culture shift?
Well, again, I think, you know, we're our agency, I retired from the Orange County Sheriff's Office after 27 years, rose to the rank of captain, spent 15 years on the SWAT team. I worked undercover. I did everything you could imagine. And there, I had a blessed career. I was just very, very fortunate. But again, I think halfway through, when we started seeing those law enforcement officers killed in the line of duty, when we started seeing the effect on the families and the effect on the officers, we started to see the sheriffs at the time really start to get engaged. And didn't really everybody quite know what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I think that's still sometimes the point, the case today. But they started to get engaged, and you started seeing people trying to talk about it. You know, it's a good thing when you bring something up and you start to get the resistance, at least you got the conversation going. So don't be afraid of starting that conversation going, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. that's what it takes to mm-hmm. start something new.
Yeah.
You know, nobody likes it. Nobody wants to be the person that starts something new that nobody else wants to participate in. But you've got to be consistent, right? It's consistency that builds excellence every single time, and no matter what you're trying to do.
Yeah. I know from our end, Gabe and I work for mental health and substance use facilities. You know, we have individuals coming in under a Baker Act. And for any of you watching that don't know what a Baker Act is, a Baker Act is when someone comes in involuntary to a hospital due to mental health issues. So we work a lot with law enforcement, bringing in individuals under a Baker Act. And I've seen quite a bit of change over the past few years too, just in policies, protocols, how we bridge the gap. And on your end, you're seeing individuals where you don't know if they're going through a mental health crisis when you arrive on the scene. What's that like?
Yeah. It's kind of tough. You know, it's tough for a doctor to diagnose somebody, right?
It is.
You'll take weeks and weeks or months to diagnose somebody.
Right.
But sometimes we expect law enforcement officers to show up on a scene and have a diagnosis. So this guy suffers from, you know, one of the 1,000 something pages in the statistical manual now. That just isn't realistic.
Not for anyone.
But we try to have these officers recognize something's unusual.
Right.
Something, you know, we don't need to know any more than that.
Okay.
At the particular time so that we can start getting other resources there. Other resources being medical resources, other resources being possibly psychological resources, whether that's through the crisis management call, whether that's through some of our officers that are specially trained. And we're unique in our agency because our officers are 100% CIT trained.
Can you explain to the viewer a little bit of what does that mean, CIT chain?
Yeah, it's a critical incident or crisis incident training, so that we do a special 40-hour class with all of our officers. Most of the agencies are trying to get to about the 60% level, but because we're small, you know, I left a gigantic agency and came to a small agency, but because we're small, we just don't have all the resources everybody else has as well. So we want to make sure that all of our officers within the first year of employment with the Windermere Police Department get trained in that. So typically through Aspire or one of the other organizations that offer the classes, they go through this 40-hour class and learn about all the different ways to interact, learn about talk down therapy, learn about crisis management, and they really get a good input. And what I really like about the class as well is they kind of usually take a personal level. There's probably nobody in this room that hasn't been affected by mental health, by substance abuse, by alcohol abuse, by whatever the case may be. You know, I have a brother who lives in New York. I say, I've got four siblings. We're all involved in the criminal justice system. My brother and I down south are police officers. The other two have been in jail or been in mental health facilities or been in, actually for my brother, he's been in rehab his entire life, 50-something years old to this day. You know, and he's in and out of jail, in and out of rehab because he's a drug user. I tried to talk to him last night. I talk to him every once in a while. So I don't think you probably can't have anybody sit in this chair and not have been affected in some way or another by one of these crisis events. So this is a great, I always say as a trainer, as a teacher, when you can connect somebody personally with something that's going on in their life, what happens is you begin to build trust with them. That's one of the best mm-hmm. teaching and components you can do. When you can build trust with somebody, that's when you earn the right to speak into their lives and make something happen. It's not by doing PowerPoint presentations mm-hmm. or anything else, mm-hmm. right? It's by taking the time. Whenever I keynote speak, I tell everybody the same thing. greatest gift you can ever give anybody is your time and attention. Give it out freely. And the worst thing you can lose in life is trust.
Yes.
We've all probably been there, right? Whether it's a personal relationship, whether it's in a law enforcement community or your job. When we lose trust, I mean, that's something that affects our psyche. Like it just is demoralizing to you, right? Puts people into really bad positions. And so I really try to capitalize. That's the way we try to run our agency, by what's called a value-based police department, by understanding those two concepts and our motto, which is honor, integrity, and service. And how do we live by all those things? And we live by them by earning people's trust. Mm.
Have you seen any difference since you've implemented that Everyone BCIT trained in certain calls?
I think so. Certainly, you know, we're a small agency. I used to run a community policing agency department in the sheriff's office. A great department, nothing negative. But traditionally, you'll see those go out and do barbecues and things of that nature, take a few pictures on Facebook. But we have a level of service that is beyond any. And when I say that is that we know almost all of our residents. We truly do, and the officers do. And we know that we have a handful of residents that do have mental health issues. I can think of one in particular. Certainly, I wouldn't share the name or anything else, but Finn Baker acted three times. He's called us all three times.
Mm. He trusts you.
He trusts us. Mm-hmm. You know, again, building trust in a community is huge. We did have an incident early on in my career. We had an officer Robbie German. He was killed in the line of duty, unfortunately. But about 6 months before he was killed in the line of duty, he responded to a call with a young man named Christopher. And Christopher was just out of control. Christopher was autistic. And we know we do a lot of autism training, but that particular day, nobody can control him. We're not quite sure what happened, and it was pretty bad. And when he came out, Officer Robbie German and one of Officer Quiles was there, and they drew their weapons. They weren't sure what was going on. He came running out at him, just fully enraged. And they recognized that something wasn't quite right, mm-hmm. right? That this wasn't, it was violent, but it wasn't violence. He put his weapon back in. He went hands-on because he recognized that. And subsequent to that, he actually got injured, dislocated his arm. But everything turned out as best as it could that day. It could have been a horrible situation. What's even better than that, the family loves us. Christopher loves us. They have since moved, but we're really close with them. He used to come to the police department all the time. We invited him into autism training, Christopher and a couple of other residents whose family members. I actually have an autistic granddaughter, so I was a little bit familiar about it already. So we invite the community in, and that's one of the things hopefully we get to talk about, is I'm very active in training, but very active in inviting the community in. We did active shooter training, and actually Gabe was there a couple of weeks ago.
Let's talk about that, because I think that's really important, is having the community look at you from a lens that isn't, oh, these are the bad guys, or, you know, I'm afraid of the police, sure. but from a different scope and a different perspective.
Right. What do I say? Building trust.
Yeah.
Building relationships ahead of time is important. So if you've got folks in your community, I know my granddaughter, you know, they live up in Apopka, but she's done little community events with my granddaughter and bring her in because she's very high functioning and she's a girl. Mm-hmm. So most people wouldn't recognize right off the bat, you know, until you've seen her a little bit and you're like, okay, something's a little different. But think about this, you know, like our officers, they get a chance if the community has somebody with autism or a mental health disorder, and you get to engage and know them inside and out, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. right? It's not your first time. Mm-hmm. Think about how much of just the preemptive de-escalation that would be,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
We always talk about de-escalation, but we talk about it after the fact. I show up on the scene, something's bad, now I have to de-escalate. I have to talk down, do whatever. But I show up on a scene and Christopher says, "Hi, Chief." And he automatically gets de-escalation.
Mm-hmm. Just because of the rapport.
Not for me doing anything.
Yeah.
Just because of that rapport.
Yeah.
And we've built that relationship, you know, in our community. Our local church there does the Tim Tebow event.
Okay.
You know, so we are stacked with all our officers in the Tim Tebow event. So it's a great opportunity to meet all of, you know, the kids and the adults and everybody that in and around our community for the officers to integrate with them. And exchange, you know, look at them and talk to them. And it's not, again, not the first time, right? People don't call police officers to come and have lunch with them.
No, they don't.
They call 911 when something's gone bad.
Yeah.
So if that first encounter is something's going bad. So I would encourage parents, you know, if you have a special needs child or a mental health child with mental health or autism or whatever case may be, stop by your local police department.
Yeah.
Find out who your community policing officer is. Get a, be proactive about that. Engage with them so they can engage with you. So it's just one small, it's really a great way.
I think so too. I had an officer tell me once, and this always sticks out in my mind. He's like, you know, we don't really like it when families, you know, you see a police officer sitting at Firehouse Subs or somewhere and be, tell your little kid, watch out. If you don't be good, he's going to come get you. Yeah. He's like, honestly, it's the worst thing you can say because we don't want to be seen that way. We want them to know that we're, one, here to keep you safe and to help with anything that's needed to keep the community strong.
And and I've seen some agencies do really good with the coffee and a cop and those kind of themes. Just going out in the community and kind of building that rapport with the community. So I think that goes a long way to kind of shake that stigma of law enforcement being a negative thing.
Yeah, those initiatives I think are really important. Are there any current initiatives or things that you guys are doing right now that are helpful or that you are doing to enhance the community?
Yeah, I mean, we'd be here for 2 or 3 days.
I'm here for it.
We are engaged in the community. And I tell my wife knows from September to December, I'm like, hey, listen, we've got like 3 or 4 events every weekend. We have a holiday hoopla Friday night. But we're really engaged in every. But I also bring, I'm very engaged with the West Orange County community. You know, I'm fortunate to sit on lots of boards that I think are really engaged in the community. The West Orange Dream Center, I don't know if you know what that is. It is a dream center that's set up in the East Winter Garden community to address the needs of that community. So we can take a look at the community and what they need. And we do jobs partnership over there. We have after school. We have 8 waves kids that are over there. So to take the kids in. I've done some jiu-jitsu programs over there. I get a chance to sit Very on cool. that board. They do men's ministry. They do kings and queens for the senior staff that come in.
Okay.
So lots of great events. But staying engaged with the community is extremely important.
Yeah.
So whether it's that or the Hope Center or the different boards that I sit in, I try to bring those values back to the town of Windermere. And one of the big things that we do each year is I've been involved with Sleep and Emily Peace bunk bed build for the last several years. I don't know if you're familiar with that organization. But I love it when you have a simple mission. The mission is this. Build a bed for a kid who doesn't have a bed, right?
I love that. Yeah. That's great.
Think about the domino effect. When the kid doesn't get to have a good night's sleep, doesn't have a play, all that kind of stuff. And what I love about this is, so it's been around for several years. It's been around this location for about 5 years. My wife and I have been involved for a while. And you can take an organization, fundraise, team build, some money, get a bunch of volunteers together. They build the bunk beds. We're extremely efficient and organized. We've got all the equipment, all the gear. Every guy asks, hey, do I need to bring my tools? No, we have them all. And we have this assembly line where you can drill and cut and press, and you don't have to know anything.
That sounds fun.
Never drilled anything in your life. And you come out and you do it, and you stamp the beds at the end with the iron, and we put them back in the warehouse. And we engage the community to raise the money to do that. So officers are standing side by side with the community to build these bunk beds. And then we get to tell them something that's even better. Hey, you think this is cool? Wait till you get to see when you go deliver these beds to the community. Think about delivering a bed to a kid who doesn't have a bed.
That's awesome.
How many beds did you build?
This last month we built 52 beds.
Wow, that's impressive.
They're bunk beds and they're just amazing. But the stories that I have from there just even get better. And I use this as a program. You know, I take my uniform off on the weekends and at night, and I have a kind of a first responder ministry that I do. And the last thing I do is try to get them to go out and be servant leaders. You know, and we do a lot of Facebook stuff, and we build the beds for Facebook stuff. Okay, I understand my job politically. I have to engage and make sure everybody knows that we're doing community policing. But the real magic happens when, you know, some of my officers or some officers that I get to know that are struggling, I take them on a delivery on the weekend. And these are places that I've grown up around here in policing, and they're not good areas. We don't go as a police officer. I go dressed down, T-shirts. I always tell them, you're not a cop today. Mm-hmm. Don't act like a cop. Don't wear blue line stuff. Don't wear any of this. Just be you. And we go out and we deliver beds. And we get to just, you know, we put the bed together. It comes with everything, the mattress, the pillow, you know, whether it's Spider-Man or a little girl's cupcake or whatever. And we surprise the kids at the end, and they're like, you know, Some of them like, this is my bed. I get to keep it. I'm like, yeah, they've never had a bed in their life. For my wife and I, it's a special because we lost a son in 2012, and I could never imagine that my son wasn't going to have a bed. So we get like a little special give back for us. Nobody really needs to know that. You know, it's not for the public to know or anything else, but I have taken officers who were struggling, one with a divorce, particular divorce that was going on for 6 or 7 months, and I took him out and delivered a bed. And he's like, this is the best day I've had in 6 months. Wow. Can you imagine that? So I think understanding, here's a neat thing. I'm very engaged with officer wellness and our officers' wellness and mental health. But when you do that, they also get to learn what it takes to help others struggle with their mental health.
Yeah.
So we keep trying to force PowerPoint presentations on people as opposed to showing them what this feels like.
Yeah. You can't replicate the feeling of what you just described.
You can't. Mm-mm. You can't. And I'll share one more real quick thing about that. But for me personally, I've been to two locations where I've delivered beds as a SWAT team member where we've had shootings. So you can think about that.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, that's.
If I'm to be honest with you, I left one particular one. Remember when leaving at that, people tried to kill us. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's unfortunate what happened. And I left saying, I'm never going to come back to this crap place again. Mm-hmm. I'm writing this out of my memory. And I would say things to myself like, these people don't deserve it. Mm-hmm. And I get to come back. And at this time, my wife made a comment one time. We delivered a bed and a young man and his dad, you know, just came up and he hugged us and he thanked us and then they were crying. And she's like,
you changed the narrative.
Can you imagine if you walked in 1 hour later in uniform? And I get to tell officers this, listen, you know, we're not talking about politics today, but they don't hate you. They hate what they've been told about you. Change that narrative.
Mm. Yeah, right? That's powerful.
And you'll change your life.
Let's talk a little bit about Baker Acting and working with individuals that might have mental health issues going around. We talked a little bit about identifying there's a mental health issue going on. What sort of things do you see out in the community? Are you seeing a lot of depression? Are you seeing anxiety? You know, I know there's a lot
of trends. I know we've seen some changes recently.
Yeah, absolutely. What are you seeing? Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, if anybody reads anything about mental health post-COVID, right? Mm. I mean, it's probably just a matter where you put everybody in this country on a particular spectrum or not. But I think we saw that mostly kind of, you know, just the loneliness, the depression, all the different kind of thing. We have a care program in our department. So if you're either over a certain age or you have, you know, medically, there's some issue with you, our officers will go and check on you.
That's awesome.
Pretty regularly. It is. And
how do you get linked up with that? You can just call and say, hey, I need.
Yes, they can call the Windermere Police Department. If they're a resident of the town of Windermere, they can call us. And they can contact my name, my email. Trust me, my email, my phone number is on the website. They can just call over there. We can put them on a program. But our officers will go and check on them. We check on them. Like when hurricanes come up, we do a pre-check and a post-check. If we need to get them somewhere, we'll help them do that. But all of that helps ease their anxiety when these kind of things come up. You know, it's the fear of the unknown.
Yeah. And I know it can be a scary time for someone who's undergoing a Baker Act and having to maybe get into a police officer car or, you know, for children. That's really tough, too. What are some of the things that your team does to mitigate those fears?
Yeah. Well, if it's on a scene, you know, we always try to separate, you know, that's kind of a basic thing for law enforcement.
Okay.
If you can, as easily as you can, you know, try to separate them from especially any family members being children and things of that nature. Cause you don't want to put that visual, in their mind if you don't have to. And again, most of it is good communications.
Uh-huh.
It all comes down to
understanding what's
really
going on.
Good communication and explain it to that. I tell the guys, I put all our officers through my leadership training, and my communication rule is this: communicate, communicate, communicate. When that doesn't work, over communicate.
Yes.
And that's really what you got to do, and you got to have that patience to be able to communicate and explain to them. Mm-hmm. Listen, I've done it a long time, so not everything works out as designed.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, there's a reason that they give us handcuffs and things of that nature, because sometimes things just don't go right. But we have found for us that, you know, very few times that we really had to get into physical combat struggles. I know, I think I called you just a few months ago, Gabe. I think we had the, I'm losing my mind just kind of right now, the emergency team that kind of came out for us. And it was a situation, it wasn't even a serious crime issue, but it was somebody that had to be trespassed and removed from the house and that nature. So we called the crisis mobile unit.
Tell us a little bit about crisis mobile unit. Yeah. People don't know what that is.
Yeah. So essentially, it's a mobile unit that you can call 24/7. They will come out with a licensed mental health physician that will come out or counselor.
And they come out with you guys, law enforcement.
Yeah. Well, there's a couple different ways. Okay. Now, our agency isn't big enough. Like the Orange County Sheriff's Office has actually a particular unit.
Okay.
Now, again, they're kind of Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, sometimes on the weekends, and we work 24/7. I have a great relationship with them because the guy that started that program used to work for me at the sheriff's office, and I know he's since moved on. So maintaining those connections is extremely important, whether it's the sheriff's office or the mobile crisis unit. Where, again, you can make that phone call, so you have a trained counselor that can come out.
That's great.
And maybe talk to somebody.
Yeah.
And our officers, I will say, they did an amazing job. You know, they showed up. I was on vacation that day, as a matter of fact. So they showed up, and I got the phone call because we're a small town. And what happens if something happens in our town, people actually start calling me personally, trust me all the time. Hey, the helicopter's up.
The back line, right?
All the cops are all going next door. What's going on, Chief? So so the guys called and they said, hey, here's what's going on. You know, she's just kind of really being belligerent. She's not coherent. Yeah. You know, she made some comments that, hey, God told me to stay here and I'm not leaving. And actually that really was a statement they said. And they said, Chief, we don't want to go in and drag her out. I said, let's call the crisis mobile unit. And they're like, oh, that's a great idea. So we called them out and they showed up about 30 minutes later and got out there and was able to talk to her. You know, they still had to physically go hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
But like I told the officers, they're kind of like, well, you know, it wasn't the 100% best outcome that they wanted that time. But listen, we used everything that we had available to us.
Yeah.
You guys are CIT trained. Everybody's trained here. We called out the crisis mobile unit. We did everything in the public, and we can be transparent with the public and say, we did everything we could.
Mm-hmm. And it was a safe outcome.
And it was a safe outcome. It wasn't a violent outcome or anything else. I mean, she resisted, but it wasn't really much more than the officers having to kind of put her hands behind her back and calm her down. But the nice thing was that when we got her into the vehicle, we set her down. The counselor came back over and spoke to her again, you know, to get her calmed down a little bit more, explain the process, explain what's going on. So again, a better outcome for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like what you said too about communication. I think that is the key to anything. If you understand what's happening even before it happens, that's really helpful to anyone.
Yeah. And this is kind of a new co-responder model that's kind of being introduced. Yeah. Where do you see the future of mental health and law enforcement? What direction do you see this going in?
Yeah. You know, you're right. That's new. It kind of started in Texas, right, a couple of years back, and we're seeing that. You know, I'm a big intelligence-led policing and analyst-type driven. So I want to kind of see where that's, because, again, I think we're going to get mixed. I think what we need to do is we need to integrate them fully. I am always about integration training. One of the first ones at the sheriff's office to integrate the jujitsu program in 99 and doing jujitsu together and firearms. And firearms instructors like, there's no way we can do that. But I'm like, wait a minute, we do everything together. You might be saying, well, why are you talking about firearms and jujitsu? Because I integrate mental health training with my jujitsu training, with my firearms training. We need to stop segregating our training. And people say, well, how much mental health training do you do? I'm like, well, what do you mean? We do classes. But we integrate it with everything.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about it continuously.
Which is probably more impactful than because
it's ingrained.
Yeah.
Man, at that point.
Yeah.
You have to integrate that, you know. And I think I really took a hold of this. And in 2004, I led the training division, and I authored an article called Taser Task Force Final Results, and I published an article about the introduction of the new tasers, but this new phenomenon called excited delirium. You guys are familiar with delirium and things like that. And it's just kind of what we were seeing with some of these cases and deaths and things like that. And did some research and study and found out delirium was kind of really a psychological medical phenomenon that they went all the way back to the early 1900s. And we were seeing this a lot with people who with prolonged exposure to drug usage.
Okay.
Crack cocaine was really prolific. you know, in the 80s and then to the 90s. So we saw people that were under great exacerbation, you know, running and fighting and things like that. Their heart rate would just increase to such a level. They would get extremely hot. They would sweat profusely and do all these things that you could physically see. And essentially, it would go into cardiac arrest. So through that, I had a subcommittee of four medical doctors that we brought aboard. And we had them tell us, what can we do? What can we do when we see this? And kind of like when we started off the conversation, we're like, well, it takes a while to diagnose somebody. But what you can do is if you see them, somebody with just extreme violence, pacing around, just seemed to be in a delirious state, sweating profusely, you know, all these kind of things, get medical and psychological help as soon as you can. Create some distance, use some talk down therapy, clear the perimeter with other people so there's no innocent bystanders that can be hurt. So these are all good tactical things that we could do and start integrating.
Yeah.
And again, we started doing that as early as about 2004. We integrated into our policy, and that's when we started having police officers in Orange, or deputies in Orange County Sheriff's Office, when they would respond and see this kind of a crisis, immediately call for additional help and resources. So that was the best we could do at that time. Now we're starting to try to integrate some of those resources in, maybe if we can recognize and identify calls for services ahead of time.
Yeah.
And I think as we build things out, it'll get better, right? Because as we build out like our CAD, our computer-aided dispatch, if we happen to go, you know, if we happen to go to Gabe's house and we know that, you know, there's a certain reason we go there and there's a certain kind of dynamic that's going on there and we go there four or five times, well, as we build those things out, we know, hey, we get a call. Here's what's going to happen. Hey, let's go ahead and call somebody ahead of time.
You have the notes in front of you. You know what to kind of expect. So,
Right. And that's how these things get better over years, right? And then nothing happens
overnight.
It really doesn't.
Yeah, that's one of the things I'm starting to, working more with law enforcement, I'm starting to appreciate. Certain agencies will have people that will call me when they have certain patterns, right, of calls. And, you know, if they send someone to one of our facilities, usually they'll try to communicate, hey, you know, this is like the third time we've been out here. You know, what can we look at to do something different? And I know they're doing it to try to change that person's life because that's not a good quality of life to have. You know, law enforcement being called to your house, you know, on a regular basis.
Certainly.
Yeah. And I'm hearing more and more of that, of, you know, case management styles and wellness checks and following the individuals that you're seeing those repeat behaviors in. I think that changes the culture of our whole entire community on how we view things and how we help people.
It does. You know, it's, again, I still get back to, again, my kind of thing that I do is team building, organizational leadership, but it's about team building. Right. That's all it is. Once you get to know somebody, you've built that trust with them. And when law enforcement agencies take that little extra effort to do that, or when citizens, you know, listen, when I was at the sheriff's office, again, I will say, you know, we have more officers per capita in the town of Windermere than they do at the sheriff's office or others, because it's just so huge. And the fact, the reality is, when I ran the sheriff's office sector as a captain, area I'm at now, I ran Pine Hills, Winter Garden, Ocoee, Dr. Phillips, and Oakland. I had all that area of unincorporated Orange County. And I would often go to a resident's house in Dr. Phillips or Windermere, unincorporated, a nicer area. Maybe they have a car burglary or something like that. And they'd say, hey, you know, Captain, I don't see police officers, or I don't see your deputies over here. And I'm like, well, we have a particular area where we had 200 burglaries, and you had two over the last 3 or 4 months. So all my resources are over there. And I'm not faulting them. All the resources are there where it needs to be, but they're just going from call to call to call. You can't community police that way. I just interviewed an officer the other day. I'm about to give I gave a conditional offer hire. She's with a bigger agency, loves it, great agency. And she's like, I can't do community policing. I get in my car and I go pick up a call. I go pick up another call. I go pick up another call. Maybe I have time for lunch. Maybe I have time to run to the bathroom. It takes us a while to get all her gear off. Then I'm going from call to call to call.
I was going to say, that's got to be taxing, because you really are, in a lot of cases, seeing people on their worst day or some of their worst days. And it's call after call after call. I know that can accumulate for an individual. So what advice would you give to first responders and officers that are, you know, kind of going through that?
Oh, you know, that's important. It's important to be able to take the uniform off, and we give them lots of different, literally physical advice. to okay. do that. That's one of the things I do. When you come home, you know, have a space for yourself where you can declutter yourself. You can physically take your uniform off, put it somewhere else. You can take off and like, I'm no longer chief. I'm Dave. I'm husband. I'm dad. I'm papa. Whatever the case may be. That is a huge psychological component for people to just switch that mindset. And then to have something with your loved one that that maybe indicate maybe you need a little bit more time that particular day. Hey, I need to go take a shower. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. I need to kind of physically, I need to wash this off. What happened right. today? I need to kind of do this. And you know, communicate ahead of time. I need to kind of do these things to do that. And for our officers, I tell them all the time to just to be have an overall balance. And, you know, for me, there's all kinds of mental health paradigms out there for me, but I really talk about mental, physical, spiritual, and relational. And we've seen mental health in law enforcement now talked about for 30 years. We're losing the battle when it comes to officer suicide and things of that nature. I personally believe this because we are afraid, and most executives run at the thought of spiritualness or talking about somebody's relationship. They just say, hey, go talk to a counselor. And I'm like, I think we've made a huge mistake. You know, your spiritual beliefs, you know, whether you're religious or not religious, what are your values? What are your beliefs? What are your set of morals? Mm-hmm. What's your sense of right and wrong? What is your faith? And I do this. I do have a personal strong faith, but I tell people I define faith as where you put your trust when things really go bad in your life. Mm-hmm. We can all, right? You can be a Christian or a Catholic or a Muslim. You can be whatever you want. And that is a great definition of faith.
It really is.
Right? But as a leader, I want to know what your faith is, what you put your faith in, because that's how I have an opportunity to help you. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. If you're telling me, you know, I used to go to church all the time. I really enjoyed it. I like this particular group, and I see things going down. Hey, Gabe, you know, how's your church been doing? I haven't been going. Oh, what's going on? Opportunity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whatever it is. You know, you'd have a group of men that you do fishing with. I love to do that. I take a group of guys fishing all the time. And
I love that you know your people, too. I think that probably makes more of an impact than maybe you even know, the fact that you care enough to know what their faith is and know when you can just tell they might need a little boost.
And that early intervention is huge. Yeah. What are some signs to look out for officers or anyone in law enforcement who might be struggling that might stand out, or things to look out for?
Oh, wow. There's a lot. You know, there's kind of really conditions you can almost put on some officers. You can see 1 year, 5 year, 10 years, things
really?
Like that. Yeah, you know, isolation.
Okay.
Don't isolate yourself, especially from your family and your loved ones. Mm-hmm. You get in this line of work and all a couple of years down the road, and it's tough, right? It's tough when you see a child drowning. It's tough when you see these certain things. You don't want to come home and share that. But you need to engage your family at some level. Maybe even get professional counseling how to do that if you're not quite sure it would do that. So don't isolate yourself. You know, that's the biggest thing is isolation. When people start getting depressed, you start feeling like, you know, you hate this job or you hate people. Mm. Right? I've heard years ago an officer told me, I hate these people. And we, you know, I'm like, hey, man, let's go have a beer tonight. And when you and I are going to sit down and talk. And he was at the end of his career, and I said, hey, it's time. It's time.
Yeah.
You know, this is time for you to kind of move on and move to something else. And he took that advice, and he kind of, you know, a couple of years later, he's like, it's the best advice anybody ever gave me. Mm-hmm. You know, I did 26 years. I didn't need to do any more. He goes, and I just got to the point. So you feel that. That's probably true for any job, right?
Yeah.
You walk in and you're just like, I can't stand being here. Then it's time. So, yeah, I think isolation is that. I think when you're just feeling that your attitude is changing, you got to check yourself. You got to have somebody. Mm-hmm. You've got to have
a plan probably in place. Yeah.
You got to have a plan. You got to have a community. Mm-hmm. You know, getting through some of the toughest things that I ever got through in my life was because of community that I was a part of. And that was the most important thing. We are not designed to do life in isolation.
That's so true.
That is not a good thing for us. And when you feel that happen, I hope that you have somebody in your life that can speak into your life and tell you. It's just like, hey, you know, Dave, this isn't going well.
Yeah.
Let's come on, let's do this. And we have to do that a little bit better. a lot better. I will tell you the huge difference that I see. I spent almost 15 years on the SWAT team. I was a team leader there, probably one of the most, when you talk about being promoted, that was one of the proudest moments. Because it's the structure base in there is not just about performance base. That's relative. Everybody on the SWAT team is top tier, but it's trust base. And what I mean by that is that your team picks the leader. Everywhere else I've tested, you know, I've passed the test, I've done this and I've gone on a test. Okay, cool. So what? Anybody can pass a test. But when your team picks you, and that's how usually special operations teams do it, that's saying something different. But those particular nights that we would have five or six search warrants, maybe an active shooter or a hostage situation, whatever the case may be, you know, we would get together and, you know, maybe we go to a local bar, have a beer or two. Nothing wrong because you're just a small group of guys. You're not going out of control or anything else. But maybe some of the guys would, you know, talk about their personal life. And I say this all the time. You know, I had guys, there's no doubt in my life, that they would step in front of a bullet for me. No doubt about it. But if I was telling them about a personal issue I was having with a personal, you know, with my marriage or family or something that was just deep and something like that, they didn't know how to handle it. And they would say something stupid like, there's plenty of other fish in the sea. I mean, worst advice you can give somebody, right? trying to yeah, reconcile or help your marriage. And I don't say that to hurt anyone, but we weren't educated.
Yeah.
Right.
Being comfortable sharing vulnerabilities is harder than it seems.
It took me a long time how to learn that.
Yeah.
You know, and listening to each other too.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'd rather you put a gun on my hand and give me a hostage situation or, you know, a bunch of gang members or a terrorist group that comes in there. I know what to do. It's easy. You know, all of a sudden you go through some real personal tragedy and you're like, you're lost. You're like, I can't. The worst thing for you to admit is that you can't handle something.
Absolutely.
Right. And if you can't handle something when allegedly you can handle a hostage situation, you know, because the world thinks, oh, my goodness, that's tough. That's pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
That's
that makes sense.
Pretty easy, to be honest with you.
And I think a big part of that is because, like you were saying earlier, training is very important. You train a lot. Yeah. But when it comes to those personal things, we really don't have a lot of training in life, right?
Yeah.
And sharing and all that. But you train, you drill, you know, shooting, you drill, you know, tactics and so on. But
there's no protocol for being sad or experiencing loss and grief. Yeah.
Even though it's the one thing that connects us all, right?
It really is.
The community, you know.
Every single one of us. Yeah.
Yeah. We're all going to lose somebody. It's inevitable.
Yeah. It's so true. It's so true. And that's why we need each other, yeah. You know, depending on, doesn't matter if you're a police officer, if you're in mental health, everybody needs the support and help from others. Thank you so much for talking us through all the different aspects of law enforcement, what you as an officer go through and your team, about some of the issues around mental health and the initiatives. I learned a lot today. And thank you so much, even more so, for what you do for our community. It's a lot.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you for watching, and we hope to see you next time. Take care, everyone.